I'm Kara Cassidy. I'm here with Hugh Newman, and we are on a trip in Egypt. I'm with Carmen Balta, and Hugh is leading a trip with Robert Bovall. And so we just happened to run into Hugh. He's joined us for the day, and I just thought I'd catch up with him and get into his work just a little bit.
Well, my work is based upon Earth mysteries, especially to do with Earth grids and how the ancients were mapping ancient sites all around the planet. I mean, when you come to these sites, you start noticing the similarities between them. One of the things that gets me is the sheer magnitude of some of these megaliths you get in Egypt, you get in Peru, you get in Britain, and you get all over the world. It's just an obscure places, so it kind of fascinates me. And the more you look into that and the more you actually visit these places, you find things you don't expect, and you see the correlations which aren't mentioned in that many books at the moment. So I'm absolutely blown away, and coming to Egypt has just confirmed that. I've only been here a few hours, just in this morning and afternoon. I'm stunned. I'm absolutely, you know, quite amazed at what I've seen here. So it just confirms it to me. There was an ancient great civilization around the planet, and Egypt was the hub of where it all began, I think.
Have you studied the work, obviously, of Robert Bovall? Because, you know, you're co-hosting a trip with him, I understand, and you're also doing something down in Megalithomania with Michael Tellinger. So you've obviously been part of the circuit for a while, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, we run a conference in England called Megalithomania every year for the last 5 years now. We get all the top authors and researchers from all over the planet, well-known authors such as Graham Hancock, Robert Bovall, also lesser-known people. And as you mentioned, Michael Tellinger came along and did a brilliant talk this year about his research in South Africa. And so, yeah, I'm quite aware of all the different research that's come out over the years, linking up all these great sites all around the planet. And so Robert Bovall's work I've been following for a decade now, so I really have got quite a good understanding of where he's at. And so, yeah, so coming here and doing a tour with Robert is a real, you know, it's a real pleasure for me to be involved in that. And we're really coming here from the megalithic perspective, really looking at it from that, you know, looking at how the ancients were working with these great monuments. And so hopefully we're going to have an amazing time here, sort of uncover some lost secrets.
How did you get into this? Because I see from the little book that you gave me that you're investigating ley lines around the world. So I'm just curious, how did you get started?
I really started with you know, studying crop circles, funnily enough, and then that got me involved in the ancient landscape and how they're always ancient sites. And then I just got the megalithomania bug, and that was it, about 10 years ago, and it really called me, and I realised, you know, who actually are we? You know, who are our ancestors who built these places? Why aren't we told about it, with some truth? Because the academic world and the world of television doesn't give the answers we're all looking for. It's not just about the sites themselves, it's about our ancestors and our relatives, really, who built them. And so I got drawn into it through just the Earth mysteries. Another aspect I'm really interested in, apart from Earth grids and the megaliths, is Earth energies and how the ancients were working with them. And there's so much proof now that the ancients had a high understanding of this, the subtle forces that are at work, using telluric energies, different types of earth energies, also water as well, the way water moved and how they harnessed that kind of energy as well, and also fire, obviously. And I think that they used the four elements much more than we do now, where we just rely on electricity for everything. So there's a whole other world, an invisible world of energies to study there, and it's not just to do with what you see with the megaliths.
So, in terms of your line of research, can you describe where you maybe started and then where you think you're headed in terms of what you might write, if you write a book, another book, or where you hope to go?
I think what I want to look at really is looking at all these different types of earth energies, using water and these different elements, and how that I believe they were using it as for fertility purposes, but also for consciousness purposes. And this is something that John Burke and others have looked at over the years. But I think there's a lot more to do with water than people realise. And there's a guy called Buster Nolan I've just met in England who's been doing research into this. And he's been introduced me to the work of Victor Schauberger. And when you start looking at that and then looking at ancient sites again, you realise there's a connection there. And there's even a connection with the way you can actually move, lift heavy stones when water sits at 4 degrees centigrade. And so the stones will actually float on water at certain temperatures. So there's a whole other world to look at there. And when you come to Egypt, it's well known that there's been lots of water here. There's lots of channels cut into the rock. There's underground passages. There's even a theory that goes way back, and it's actually been properly documented, that they used water actually with pools inside the pyramid. That certain, when it got to certain temperatures, the water energy would lift up the rock. I can't remember the name of the researcher. So there's a lot more to look at, I think, than just earth energies. So that's one angle I'm going in at to sort of explore that.
In terms of the places that you might have visited and investigated the ley lines, How do you investigate them, and where on the planet have you investigated them thus far?
Well, the thing I find with earth energies and ley lines and earth grids and all that kind of subject, I've got to a point with it where I think a lot of people get to eventually, where you realise you go to all the sites I've visited in the world, I've been quite far and wide to sort of explore this, you get the same things happening. You get exactly the same telluric energies, they move around in spirals. You get underground water that organises itself when the site's been designed in a certain geometrical form. And you get earth energy currents that go across the whole of countries, even all the way around the world, like the Rainbow Serpent, which is an extension of the Michael and Mary energy lines that sort of occur in Britain. And so you realise that you get to a point where there's not much, you know, you can go there with dowsing rods and you can read the energies there, and you're going to get pretty much the same results, I think. I don't think anything more unique is going to come out of that beyond what dowsers have found, geomancers, and John Burke and other researchers. And so I feel there's a whole, I think we need to start looking at it from a different perspective, where we start looking at the elements again. This is something I mentioned already. And also with the way sites line up around the planet, there's a whole geodetic system going on, which is something that Giza is specifically really the centre of. Yeah. And this is what I cover in my book about Earth grids. And when you start laying out, you know, where all the sites are on the planet and start measuring the degrees and distances between places, you find correlations which are quite remarkable, as though they were mapping and they were surveying. And then wherever they chose a geodetic marker, they were then harnessing the energies there. So then this leads into the whole grid theory, that perhaps there is an energetic geometric grid, which is like a self-perpetuating energy system of the planet, which feeds us. And if you tap into it, it's an energy source that can be used for many different purposes.
Absolutely. Well, that correlates with the work of Michael Tellinger and the energy in the stones, the fact that the stones are placed in certain parts of the earth in order to facilitate accessing the energies coming up in that particular area of the planet, and then also has to do with the configuration of the stones, yeah, making that, opening the channel.
Yeah.
I guess.
For sure. I mean, this is something that I've been looking at, is the positive and negative charge of stones. Again, this is something that Buster Nolan has been introducing me to, and John Burke and Philip Callahan and other researchers have covered that over the years. But I think what I keep finding, and something that Buster sort of commented on, is that many of the sort of major ancient sites often bring stones from a long way away, because they have to have a different geology come in, and it's got to be put into a different, like, positive stone into a negative geology in the area.
Uh-huh.
Then it creates a charge, because it's sort of against each other.
Right.
Which actually creates the sort of energy itself.
Interesting.
And then you introduce water, and that, you know, and then you get the whole vortex phenomenon and electric charge from that as well. And so there's all these different, you know, things to consider.
What about the work of Bruce Cathy? Are you familiar with it? And yeah, Bruce, how does that correlate with what you're doing?
Bruce Cathy's a fascinating subject. I mean, he's one of the guys who's sort of found a grid around the planet, which he believes mm-hmm. the ETs have been using to sort of power their sort of craft or whatever it is. And he's got like quite an organized grid, kind of he thinks fits all around the planet. And the mathematics are very complicated that he uses, but very sophisticated. So he's looking at it from that perspective, like an energy grid, like that are used by other entities or whatever. But actually, there's lots of proof now that the ancients were working with that grid too. Mm-hmm. And there's a slightly different grid. I mean, his grid was based on the cube and the octahedron, whereas Beth Hargens and William Becker and these other Russian researchers based it on the icos of dodecahedron, and so you get all the different platonic solids building into these different forms and just suggests that there was some understanding of that. And I think anything with a sphere shape, like a planet, obviously has energy being produced within it and around it, goes into natural geometric shapes, and so you'll get this kind of, I think, grids naturally form, and then they can be worked with by people. I think this is probably what the ancients were doing, yeah.
What's your background in terms of your education? Did you study, I don't know, geology or anything like that?
No, I studied nutrition, which doesn't really fit. But what is interesting is one of the areas of research which kind of drew me into this earth energy stuff is the whole fertility aspect. And so when you're applying, you know, the type of rock we've got here at Giza, if you actually sprinkle that powder onto your garden when you're growing your food or your allotment, you actually get higher, it puts minerals back into the food, so you get higher mineral content, a higher nutritional value, and it charges the food as well if it's positively charged stone, if it's positively charged. And so you get all these, so nutrition does have a place. Hmm. And I think the fertility aspects isn't just to do with energy, it's to do with actually getting nutrients from the rock itself and using that, you know, for, you know, higher purposes. When you've got the proper mineral content in your body and in your brain, your neurons fire properly, and you're fully whole. You become grounded, you become more open, and it works on so many different levels. And nowadays, we don't have that kind of thing in our food supply, because most farming, it just has NPK, nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus. Mm. It doesn't have the rest of the 70 minerals that we kind of need on a daily basis.
Right.
Whereas the ancients, obviously, all around the world, they were working with stone, so they're obviously getting their minerals just by sprinkling dust where food was growing. And so, yes, it's worth having a look at that again, I think, and like applying these ancient techniques to the modern farming. And so I've sort of come from, so my nutrition studies and, you know, my megalith studies were once very separate.
Uh-huh.
They seem to have now come together, and it kind of all starts to make sense now.
This is just an impromptu interview that we sort of are catching on the run here, and I wonder if there's any areas that, simply because I'm not that familiar with your work, and I apologize for that, but it was just a great sort of serendipity meeting you here. Why is it you're working with Robert Bovall, for example? Is that just, you know, the two of you happen to be interested in going to Egypt at the same time, or is there more to it than that?
So I met Robert because of Megalithomania. We invited him to speak. Obviously, I've been following his work for years. And I introduced him to my work, and we kind of hit it off, basically. And I really wanted to sort of come to Egypt with a group of people from the conference and fellows and friends who look at everything from a sort of more megalithic perspective and a more sort of scientific kind of perspective from that kind of level. And Robert was the perfect person to do it with, so it kind of stemmed from that, really. And obviously Carmen as well. I mean, I love her Pyramid Code series. It's absolutely fascinating. It's absolutely blown me away, actually. So I've been using that as my kind of preparation, really, for coming in. And I think we're going to sort of develop things with Robert. I think we've got a lot in common, and I've introduced him to a lot of people. He's introduced me to people, and I think it's just a sort of natural, sort of harmonic relationship there.
Okay. Well, speaking of harmonics, I was just thinking that Robert Bovall's emphasis on the astronomy and how that can be picked up on these sacred sites around the world, and correlating the position of the stars, etc., and how the positions of the monoliths are put on certain areas. Obviously, there's an energetic relationship between, for example, Orion and the Egyptian pyramids and so on. Have you talked about that at all and how that might correlate also to the ley lines? Because the ley lines may take the energy from the particular nodal points and distribute it around the Earth, etc.
Yeah, I agree with you on everything you just said there. I think the other aspect of this is when you have to use astronomy and you have to sort of align sites, number one, for farming, kind of like, say, you've got a perfect calendar system, and secondly, for mapping and surveying, you really need to use the stars, especially if you haven't got like the technology we have today, like GPSs and Google Earth and things like that. And so you need the astronomy, you need to know where different places you go around the planet, you need to have an understanding of where the stars are as you move around the planet, whether you're moving north, south, east or west. And so the astronomy is essential if you want to map the planet. And then when you look at the ancient maps, the Piri's Res maps and other maps, there's very high proof now that they are extremely ancient, possibly even 10, 12,000 years old. And so the astronomy was essential to get them in place. And so I believe there's a very important correlation there, as well as the star energy and the energy of the sun and the moon stimulating the energies in the earth, by what we've already been talking about.
Sure.
So I think these are multi-purpose sites.
Yeah, it's a fascinating study, no doubt about it. And the further you go down that road, the more you realize we don't know.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Hugh. I really appreciate you taking some time with me today. Sorry that we don't have a more, we have a gorgeous backdrop, but it's not the ideal situation since we have all kinds of interruptions, and we're right in the midst of everything here. Sorry, thank you very much. I don't need any postcards at the moment, but you're a beautiful child regardless. No, thank you. Okay, so, all right, Hugh, thank you very much, and hopefully we can catch up at a later date and maybe do something a little more formal.